From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, fragile ties between the US and Afghanistan are strained once again after reports President Karzai has held secret Taliban talks.
The Taliban regard Karzai as an American puppet and they think the real power are the Americans, and so they want to negotiate with them, not with him.
We hear from our correspondent on Capitol Hill as President Obama comes under increasing pressure to stop deporting immigrants. We examine the World Health Organization's reports of an approaching tidal wave of cancer and find out why Sochi's Olympic Games are proving deadly for Russia's dogs.
Normally, culls do include poisoning of dogs or shooting of them, and even in some extreme cases, the bludgeoning of dogs.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. Afghan President Hamid Karzai has been holding secret peace talks with the Taliban, according to unnamed Afghan officials cited in the New York Times. Meanwhile, U.S. President Barack Obama met with senior defense officials to discuss Afghanistan and the sharp deterioration in relations. Nina Maria Potts reports from Washington.
Peace talks between Afghan President Hamid Karzai's government and Taliban officials have been going on for the past 2 months, according to the New York Times. At around the same time as the talks allegedly began in November, Hamid Karzai frustrated Washington by failing to sign a bilateral security deal with the U.S., which would keep up to 12,000 troops in Afghanistan beyond the full withdrawal at the end of this year. Relations have deteriorated over the Afghan leader's refusal to sign, while Washington has halved its aid for Afghanistan for 2014.
The number of executions being carried out in Iran has risen substantially, according to an analysis carried out by human rights organizations. Amnesty International says as many as 33 people were hanged in a single week last month, and human rights advocates claim the number of people being executed in the country now averages more than 66 per month. Simon Marks reports.
The figures have been gathered by a variety of organizations, and they show that in the 6 months since Iran's supposedly reformist president Hassan Rouhani took power, the use of the death penalty has accelerated. In the past half year, an average of 66 people have been executed every month. That's up from an average of 47 per month over the previous 2.5 years. U.S. officials are said to be unclear about the reasons for the increasing use of Iran's gallows, but some argue it's an attempt by hardline conservative clerics to demonstrate that they still control the real levers of power in the country.
Global restrictions on alcohol and sugar need to be considered in order to prevent a tidal wave of cancer, according to the World Health Organization. Their 2014 cancer report predicts the number of people diagnosed with cancer per year will increase by around 10 million worldwide by 2035. Jack Parrock has more.
The World Health Organization's 2014 cancer report predicts the number of people getting cancer will rise from 14 million a year to around 24 million by 2035. Focusing on preventable cancers brought on through smoking, drinking alcohol, and maintaining a poor diet, the report says at least half of the predicted infections could be averted by educating people about lifestyle and health choices. It says the idea that cancer is mainly due to family history is a misconception, with no more than 10% of cancers attributed to inherited genes.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. The United Nations deadline to get chemical weapons out of Syria is likely to be missed by more than 2 months, according to the Russian government. The most dangerous arms may not leave the country until the beginning of March. Nick Harper reports from UN headquarters in New York.
Under the United Nations plan, inspectors were meant to transport the most toxic agents from Syria's chemical weapons stockpiles out of the country by the end of 2013. That deadline slipped, and now Russia's Deputy Foreign Minister Gennady Gatilov says that won't be complete until March the 1st. Last week, the US said only 4% of the Priority 1 chemicals had so far left Syria, and accused the Syrian government of stalling. However, the joint UN team is still confident that the end of June deadline for the complete removal and destruction of all chemical weapons will still be met.
Mexican authorities have reported finding two human heads in Antunez, a community in the western part of the country, just before the Mexican president is due to visit. Officials believe the victims were casualties of the ongoing violence between the Knights Templar drug cartel and local vigilantes. A new photo from NASA's Mars rover shows the craft perched on the edge of a 1-meter-high sand dune, and U.S. engineers have decided to risk driving it over the top so it can reach an area of smoother ground and do some drilling. In order to get to the area known as KMS-9, the rover Curiosity will also have to enter a small valley known as Dingo Gap, and the world's best-known social network is celebrating its 10th birthday. Founded in a Harvard dorm room as a tool for connecting students, Facebook now boasts 1.2 billion registered users. The question is whether the site can maintain growth as it reaches saturation point in many mature markets. And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. Brittle ties between the US and Afghanistan have been tested once again after reports President Hamid Karzai has been holding secret talks with the Taliban. Excluding the US and other Western allies from the peace process is just the latest blow to relations after attempts to sign a deal on the United States' long-term military presence in Afghanistan collapsed. Earlier, I discussed the fragile position with Christina Lamb, foreign affairs correspondent for Britain's Sunday Times and author of The Sewing Circles of Herat, a personal voyage through Afghanistan.
He and his older brother, Qayyum, have been trying very hard to have contacts with the Taliban for the last few years. The problem really is the other side, that the Taliban don't want to talk to Hamid Karzai. I met a senior Taliban representative just a day ago in Dubai, who again was saying that the Taliban regard Karzai as an American puppet and they think the real power are the Americans, and so they want to negotiate with them, not with him.
But if he's a puppet of the United States, then how do we understand recent what have been described as poisonous and accusations against the United States of carrying out, certainly recently, a number of insurgent attacks or being somehow orchestrating those attacks, most recently a suicide attack on a restaurant in the Afghan capital?
Well, I think it does explain that in a way. He has, because he was installed back in 2001, seen as being installed by the US at the time, I think he's extremely concerned to show himself as independent. So some of this attacking the United States is really because of his domestic audience, that he does not want to go out as Afghan president when he steps down being regarded as that. He wants to be seen as independent. That being said, I do think he genuinely feels very strongly and has done for a long while that the US is doing things in a way that he doesn't like in Afghanistan, and that Afghan civilians are being killed, and that there's been far too much sort of focus by military commanders on killing as many people as possible and not respecting what he sees as Afghan culture and Afghan traditions. I mean, I've been going back and forth there since 2001. I'd also gone there before that. But I would say that his criticisms were true in the early days, that you did have lots of issues with military not understanding the culture and going into women's quarters and going in with dogs into people's houses, which they see as offensive, and, you know, some mistakes where civilians were killed. I think that, you know, that happens very rarely now, that the US Army and other NATO armies have tried very hard to try and understand and learn about Afghan culture and traditions. And you've also, because the war's been going on for so long, you've had the same troops going, you know, maybe on three tours, so learning much more about it. So I think his criticisms are a lot less valid now than they would have been a few years ago.
Back in November, when the deal was on the table, wasn't it, for the long-term US military presence in Afghanistan, that fell through after President Karzai attempted to slip in some last-minute conditions. Can you explain what's at stake here if this deal falls apart?
No, a huge amount is at stake. Basically, at the end of this year, 2014, all the NATO troops, currently I think there's about 57,000 still there, are due to leave. And the idea was that there would be a smaller presence of maybe 8,000 to 12,000 NATO soldiers still there next year who would assist the Afghan army, help train them, but also because of their presence there would enable them to have access to intelligence and other things, and also would be protection really for civilians that were working there from those countries. And I think the international community was astonished when Karzai refused to sign this, having actually, you know, agreed the conditions originally. The letter went back and forth between him and the Americans, and he agreed it. This big tribal assembly was held, a lawyer Jerger, in November, to get national approval, and they overwhelmingly approved it. In fact, they even asked for more bases than America had at present. And yet, he then didn't sign it and has come up with these new conditions that he won't sign until the Americans show that they're serious about the peace process, by which he specifically means he wants the Taliban to be brought to the table for talks. And as I said, the Taliban say they don't want to talk to him.
Christina Lamb, foreign affairs correspondent for Britain's Sunday Times and author of The Sewing Circles of Herat, a personal voyage through Afghanistan. This is FSN Reports. A coalition of undocumented activists, legal experts and labour unions formally petitioned the Department of Homeland Security Tuesday to stop deporting immigrants who would be protected if and when Congress finally passes an immigration reform bill, though the president has sent mixed messages in recent weeks on whether he can legally suspend deportations through an executive order. The groups say doing so is not only within his power, it's a politically savvy and morally important step towards advancing lasting reform. In Washington, our correspondent Alice Olstein has more.
Immigrants' rights advocates say they're disappointed that President Obama's new focus on executive actions has not extended to the realm of immigration reform. The president has said in the past that he's not a king and cannot make changes to the current immigration system without approval from Congress. But in a recent interview facilitated by Google Hangout, the president hinted that he could take executive action, but will refrain from doing so while lawmakers hash out the details of their immigration reform proposals.
Obviously, if at some point we see that it's not getting done, I'm going to look at all options to make sure that we have a rational, smart system of immigration. But I'm going to do everything I can in these coming months to see if we can get this over the finish line. And I think we actually can get it done.
The remarks came less than 24 hours after congressional Republicans released their long-anticipated principles for immigration reform, which, like the Senate's provisions, focus heavily on increasing border militarization and workplace enforcement. But both Republicans and Democrats say passage of a bill this year is far from certain. And in the meantime, about 1,000 people are deported every day, bringing the total number removed from the country during Obama's presidency close to an unprecedented 2 million. Jessica Karp, an attorney with the National Day Labor Organizing Network, accused President Obama of using immigration reform as a political football.
The president has ramped up immigration enforcement to unprecedented levels, while at the same time providing lip service for legalization proposals. That lets him brag about his enforcement credentials when he's speaking to nativists, and then turn around and castigate Republicans when speaking to immigrant supporters.
Karp and other immigration reform advocates gathered Tuesday just blocks from the White House to announce the filing of a formal rulemaking petition with the Department of Homeland Security. They're not demanding a path to citizenship or even permanent legal residency for the millions of immigrants who would be covered by an immigration reform bill, just temporary protection from deportation and work authorization. Petition author Gilda Holgen with the Cardozo Law School Immigration Justice Clinic says the petition refutes arguments that the White House is unable to take unilateral action.
it is true that only Congress can grant a pathway to citizenship. But it is equally true that only the president can determine whether to initiate deportation proceedings. That is the separation of powers set forth in our Constitution. The Constitution vests the executive authority with the president and the president alone. And the Supreme Court has been emphatic that this power includes virtually absolute discretion over whether, when, and against whom to initiate enforcement proceedings.
Holguin cited past presidents who have granted the same protection to groups of undocumented people, including John F. Kennedy with Cuban immigrants and George H.W. Bush with Chinese minority groups. The Department of Homeland Security has to respond to this petition, but there's no exact deadline for them to do so, besides the vague requirement that it be within a reasonable amount of time. To press for a swift response, the petitioners and other activists are planning a National Day of Action on April 5th, involving vigils and protests in cities across the U.S. aimed at pressuring the president to halt deportations. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
Now, the World Health Organization is warning we could face a global tidal wave of cancer, with the number of cases set to increase to 24 million per year by 2035. In a rapidly aging society where cancer treatment costs are increasing, the WTO is calling for a major push towards prevention, calling for restrictions on sugar and alcohol. However, the World Cancer Research Fund says there's an alarming level of naivety about the relationship between diet and cancer. For more on the subject, FSN's Rebecca Hume spoke to Alice Bender, Associate Director for Nutrition Programs at the American Institute for Cancer Research.
This is something that we actually have known for quite a while, that many cases of cancer can be preventable. And we know in the U.S. certainly that cancer cases are increasing, partly due to lifestyle. And as we see those changes globally, we can expect those kinds of changes to occur in other countries as well as people do smoke more. Their lifestyle is, you know, more sedentary, eat more Western-style diets, so that, and also as obesity increases worldwide.
In this report, the World Cancer Research Fund has also come out and said that there's an alarming level of naivety about the diet's role in cancer. I mean, do you think this is accurate? Do you think people are actually that naive that they sort of don't make these correlations?
Well, again, I can tell you, I know that they did that survey in the UK. We did a similar one here in the US and found similar things that, you know, fewer than half the people are aware of some of these links between diet and cancer, between physical activity and cancer, between obesity and cancer. A lot of people just feel like there's nothing they can do, that cancer is just something that happens.
So do you think there's been enough awareness raised in this area by sort of government campaigns and awareness charities? I mean, do you think enough has been done to educate people about the role that diet plays?
Well, no, I don't think there has been. Obviously, the message has not gotten out to enough people. I think we've done a really good job with tobacco. People understand and know that is a cause of cancer. Also, that too much sun also is a risk factor for cancer. But as far as these lifestyle choices, that just does not seem to be, you know, in people's minds as much as it should be.
But this sort of opens up, to my mind, a whole array of other possibilities coming in. I mean, what about in the developed world where they're saying there's a huge number or higher number of cases of cancer? What about the fact that we have busy lifestyles and there's a lot of stress-related conditions? I mean, where's the research going into these kinds of factors?
Yes, that's something we really do not know, you know, so much about stress per se, but certainly that makes it harder to make the healthy lifestyle choices that we need to make. And those choices aren't always affordable and accessible to a lot of people around the world.
Do you feel that we're really facing a global crisis in the next two decades, as sort of stated in this report, or do you think that this could be sort of reversed if there's enough education and awareness sort of put into this?
I think with enough education, awareness, but also action, we know that we need more than just education and awareness. We also need, as I said before, we need action from governments, from food companies, from employers, from all you know, levels of society to help us make, as I said, to make the healthy choice the easy and accessible and affordable choice.
Alice Bender, Associate Director for Nutrition Programs at the American Institute for Cancer Research. Now, as Russia prepares to stage this Friday's Winter Olympics opening ceremony, the host city of Sochi has come in for international condemnation over its treatment of the local stray dog population. A Russian pest control firm has been hired to cull thousands of dogs as part of preparations for the Games. Authorities claim the dogs pose a danger to international visitors. For more on the story, I spoke to Humane Society International Director Kelly O'Mara.
Well, Humane Society International has recently learned of a hired company by the Sochi government to kill the Sochi street dogs leading up to the Games. And some time ago, in the summer of 2013, there was an announcement made by the Sochi government that they had planned to cull 2,000 street dogs leading up to the Sochi Games this winter. And there was a large international outcry, and Humane Society International was part of that. And as a result, the government did announce that it would be halting those plans and considering other options. We have since learned very little about what those plans became. We had been told that there was going to be potentially a large shelter in place of the cull, but it wasn't until very recently that we learned that, in fact, a hired company was hired to kill the dogs as an alternative to the government doing it themselves.
The owner of the company that's been enlisted by Russian authorities to take care of this stray dog problem is a man called Alexei Sorokin. And a couple of quotes from this guy over the last few days on this subject of the dog cull. He described the dogs in Sochi as biological trash. And he also suggested that were a dog to somehow infiltrate the opening ceremony this Friday, it would be a national shame for Russia. Clearly, he's made his mind up about the stray dog population in Russia.
Yes, they've certainly used extreme examples of how these dogs could affect the Games, and certainly coming up with excuses as to why they would resort to cruel means of culling dogs rather than certainly more humane and more effective alternatives, which we have offered to help them develop in the past.
I'm sure the methods of culling differ greatly from country to country. Do we have any idea yet what method is being incorporated in Sochi?
Well, we've not been able to find out the exact details, nor have we been able to find out the actual number of dogs that have been killed at this point. But normally, culls do include poisoning of dogs or shooting of them, and even in some extreme cases, the bludgeoning of dogs. We have heard reports of likely it's poisoning, which, of course, is incredibly inhumane for any dog to die from. It's a very painful way for an animal to die. And we have encouraged them as much as possible in the past and over the last decade that this is not a way to be handling or managing the street dog population. It is incredibly cruel towards the animals, but it also is incredibly ineffective. And we have humane measures and effective ways of handling and managing street dog populations that include mass sterilization, mass vaccination, and community education.
And what exactly is the threat, according to Russian authorities?
It really comes down to their fear of the dogs biting the people, rabies being an issue. And, of course, you know, public health is always an issue when you have street dogs and you have them roaming. But, again, this is not a way to properly manage or humanely manage the populations. And there certainly will be an international outcry and consequences to this because a majority of the people who are going over to Russia to see the Sochi Games are dog lovers. And they will take great offense that this is what has been done to the dogs leading up to the Games for their safety.
Kelly O'Mara with Humane Society International. Now to Russia's neighbour, Ukraine, where large-scale anti-government protests continue. The country's president, Viktor Yanukovych, has returned from work following sick leave, with opposition MPs laying out new demands for changes to the constitution. At the same time, demonstrators continue to pack Kiev's Independence Square. Jennifer Carroll, a PhD student at the University of Washington, has been living in Ukraine's capital for the past 18 months and has witnessed the growth of the protests. FSN's Priscilla Huff spoke with Jennifer via Skype to learn why the people of Kiev have taken to the streets.
I think that's a much deeper question that's more difficult to answer, and it is reflective of you know, a younger generation in Ukraine that has not grown up in the Soviet Union coming into adulthood, of greater influence with outside cultures, outside media, outside art and culture. And a larger cultural shift that's happening here, even a year and a half ago, what, at least to my American eyes, defined so much of what happened in Ukraine in terms of politics, public policy, health policy, social policy. There was a great deal of fatalism here, a great deal of belief that the system was too entrenched in corruption and cronyism to ever really be pulled out of it. And the intense hope and sort of creative aspirations for the future of what Ukraine could be that is appearing in Maidan right now on the streets is something that, to be perfectly honest, I have never seen in Ukraine. And I have been coming here, living here, conducting research here since 2007. Certainly those sentiments have always been there. Certainly this did not appear out of nowhere, but it is really materializing in a way that is very, very new.
Despite some promises of change, and in fact today there's yet another promise of some constitutional change, what is keeping people continuing to stay in Maidan Square, return to Maidan Square, continue to face off against the Ukrainian police and the Ukrainian military?
Well, one of my favorite things about what has been happening in Maidan has been the creative artistry that's been going on. There's a lot of stickers that have been going around. And one of the very, very first stickers that was printed and plastered all over coats and book bags and walls and post office windows, there was one that said, the primary goal is Yanukovych's resignation, and one other that said, I will not leave Maidan until Yanukovych resigns. That has been the definition of victory in this protest movement essentially since the beginning of December, and that is still the way in which people are talking.
And when you go to Maidan Square, what do you see people of Ukraine asking for? Is it, as you were saying, a generational divide that the younger generation wants to turn toward what they see as the opportunity of the West?
One of the very interesting things about Maidan that has been very different from other sort of protests that have arisen in Kyiv in the last few years is that there actually is a huge demographic mix here. There are students coming, there are professors, lawyers, doctors, young people, old people, families with children, pensioners. There's even a frequent sight out here is older women in floor-length fur coats. It's been a joke that the new winter fashion in Kyiv is, they're called shuba, so floor-length shuba with orange hard hats. And most people here tend to be in great agreement about what they want, which is a fundamental change to this system. The government, especially the government under the control of the Party of Regions, is understood by many people here to be the result of a gradual takeover of the Ukrainian state by a mafia network that existed in the southeast part of the country. You know, many people outside of Ukraine are not aware that Yanukovych actually has a criminal history. He has spent time in jail for robbery. He has spent time in jail for sexual assault. And now he's running the country. So for the most part, pretty much everyone has the same goal in mind, which is essentially liberating the Ukrainian government from this group of people who have come in from the southeast. There is disagreement about how that should best be achieved, but for the most part, there has been a fantastic amount of harmony with protesters here.
Jennifer Carroll, a PhD student at the University of Washington, living in Kyiv. And that's Tuesday's edition of FSN Reports. You can tell us what you think of the programme by emailing us, reports@featurestory.com. And you can follow us on Twitter. We're there at Feature Story. Coming up on Wednesday, the long-awaited farm bill comes into focus. We'll have all the details from Capitol Hill. That's Wednesday, but for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with Feature Story News everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.